That's my music. Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. My guest for this program, once again, so glad to have you, David Steinberg, back. Welcome.
Well, thanks. Good to talk to you.
It's always good. We last saw each other at the Seattle Erotic Arts Festival, and that was in April.
Right.
And you are a regular there and a master of, it's a master of photography, I think. Can you just tell the listening audience, before we get into our main topics for this program?
I think they call it master of erotic art is what
yes.
they Yeah.
And then tell us just a little bit about your history. We've discussed it on this program because you've been a guest a number of times, but what you do, because it fascinates people, and it's something very unique.
Well, since 1999, I guess, I've been photographing couples being sexual at home, trying to get some honest emotional photos of regular people like you and me being sexual, because there just is not a lot of that imagery around. There's plenty of pornography around or glamorized photography around, but photography that focuses on the emotions involved in being sexual, there's very little of that around. And I just decided to, back in those days, like it's almost 20 years ago now, to experiment with trying to get some honest photos of people being sexual at home, which is somewhat of a tricky project, as you can imagine, since
yes.
sex is generally a private thing, not something you do in front of a photographer. But for people who open to the idea of being photographed while they're being sexual, it gives them a chance, first of all, to see what that's like, and second of all, to end up with photographs of themselves in their sexual place, which they have no way of doing otherwise. And since that time, I've photographed, I guess it's about 170, 180 couples at this point, all different ages, body types, sexual orientations, sexual preferences, that's just become a big part of my work.
And some of that work is featured in your book, This Thing We Call Sex, A Radically Sensible Look at Sex in America. I recommend it to you listeners. As James Peterson said, he's the former Playboy advisor, author of The Century of Sex, and he said, this is a blurb in the beginning of your book, "Since sex became a legitimate beat for journalists, David Steinberg has been the right man in the right place at the right time. Moving beyond the role of witness, consumer, or critic, he participates, fascinated with the emotional power of what's happening before his eyes. His prose is honest, sometimes funny, sometimes angry, but always just. If you've ever wondered about the incredible ongoing whirlwind of sex, read this book." High praise from James Patterson.
Yeah, I was delighted to hear what he had to say. So, yeah, the book is a collection. I wrote a column called Comes Naturally, a monthly column, for 15 years, and the book is a collection sort of the best of those columns, the ones that are most relevant still, together with some new material. And that came out 3 years ago, I guess, now.
Yes.
I decided to include with the written material some of the photography, since that's what I've been doing in the time since I stopped writing the column.
And it is a fascinating read, and the photographs that accompany each chapter are just great. They're so real. I mean, all body types, all ages, all genders, sexual orientations. It's a wonderful book. I recommend it. People can get this book through Amazon, I guess, or on your website. It's davidsteinberg.us.
Yes, davidsteinberg.us is my website. You can get the book and other books that I've done there, as well as through Amazon.
Yes. And about 30 years ago, more than that now, my goodness, because I've known you a long time, I got your book, Erotic by Nature. And then about, 7 years ago, I heard that you were still selling some of these books. So I bought one for my now husband, Brian, and he loves his copy. And I think you signed it for him, which is great. Tell the listeners a little bit about Erotic by Nature, because it is still available, I guess, here and there.
Yeah, no, that's also available through Amazon and through my website. Erotic by Nature, it came out in 1988. It's a hardcover book of erotic photography combined with erotic short stories, plus a few drawings and a few poems. But most of it is stories and photographs. And it came out of a desire on my part to produce a book that portrayed eroticism and sexuality in a way that was an alternative to commercial pornography. I mean, we were all critical of pornography for basically its sexism and its attitude about sexuality and men and women. And for some of us, that raised the question of why don't we try to come up with something that does this better? And we were convinced that a lot of people's interest in pornography is not exactly that they want exactly that, but that's all that's available to anybody who's curious about sexuality, either, and especially in visual imagery. So after, it took about 5 years, but I put together that book, and we produced it a very low-key, low-cost way, but it found its audience. It's sold, I don't know, I think 13 or 14,000 copies now, which is quite a lot for an expensive art book.
Yes.
It lists for like $45. And it demonstrated what we thought, which was that people would be interested in imagery and stories about sexuality that portray sexuality in a more thoughtful way.
And that's what you do always. In your book, This Thing We Call Sex, I mean, you know that sex is who we are and how we live and how we experience desire, yearning, joy, and life. So it's a fascinating book, and people should get it. If you think you have sex figured out, you're probably wrong. I mean, I've been working in this field for 37 years, and I'm still making new discoveries, although fewer of them. A small study was done of sex therapists wondering if sex therapists had better sex than the average person. And it turns out, this was just a small study, but it turns out we do. And that's because we can have sex without anxiety, because we have a lot of knowledge. Knowledge is power. And it can reduce the anxiety, right?
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
So much shame and doubt that people have about their own sexuality. Am I okay? Am I attractive? Are my desires proper or improper? We're taught to turn against ourselves and our sexuality in so many ways. So anything that, from my point of view, anything that encourages people to accept and embrace who they are, even if their sexual preferences and desires and fantasies or whatever surprise them sometimes, rather than say, oh my God, there's something wrong with me, to basically give yourself a break. And, you know, assuming that we're not talking about anything that's non-consensual or harmful.
Exactly.
To people and so on. That, you know, whatever you're interested in is fine. It's really all fine and a part of being alive. So in the 158 columns that I wrote when I was doing that, plus other articles actually that I wrote at the same time, what I would come back to over and over again was trying to talk about sexuality in a matter-of-fact, non-hysterical sort of way.
Non-hysterical. Mm-hmm.
So that, the same way we would talk about anything else in life, and to even talk about aspects of sexuality that might not be right down the most common mainstream boulevard of people's sexuality, looking at a lot of it and saying, well, you know, so what's wrong with this, or why is this not okay? And just trying to take a look at various aspects of how sexuality and eroticism and desire come up in our lives in a way that just doesn't, like you say, have so much anxiety and self-doubt.
I see my role as a therapist to create a space where the diversity of experiences can be explored with compassion. So I see lots and lots of couples. And I think understanding both sides is crucial, whether a couple chooses to end a relationship, for instance, after an affair, or intends to stay together, whether they're going to rebuild and revitalize. And I teased with the affair, because we're going to talk in moments here about monogamy and the fallout from monogamy is often affairs. So we're going to focus in on that. And as you have a chapter in your book, The Myths of Monogamy. And let's start with the first myth of monogamy. Because I think it's really important that we 3 years ago we did discuss this on this program, but it's been 3 years. So,
yeah.
And it seems like in the West, sex is a right linked to our individuality, our self-actualization, and our freedom. So it can be a loaded topic, monogamy. But what do you say in your chapter? I know, but tell our audience kind of the highlights.
Well, the chapter was written some time ago. It actually came up at a time when a woman who was a lieutenant in the Air Force was being drummed out of the Air Force for having had an affair with the husband of one of her subordinates, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
So it raised the whole question about why is it that having an affair is such a horrible thing that if you do that, you're no longer qualified to serve in the military, for example. And we've seen it elsewhere, politicians who have affairs getting drummed out of office. If you have an affair, then you're no longer fit to be an elected public servant, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So first of all, it's when I was very young, I accepted the monogamy assumption that we're all fed, but pretty early on in my life, in my 20s, it became clear to me that certainly didn't make sense for me, and then made me ask questions about why is it that everybody thinks monogamy is some natural or preferable or God-ordained way that people should structure their lives. So the first notion that I came up with about monogamy, which I call the first myth of monogamy, was that the natural order of things is you find a mate, you feel attracted to your mate, and assuming things go well for the rest of your life, you never feel attracted to anybody else in your whole life. Like as if that was the natural order of things. And I think that there have been long times in history, in the history of Western culture at least, where people have thought that was the way that human beings were wired, and that if you were not wired that way, that there was something wrong with you. And I think it seems to me clear, and I know, I guess people could debate it, but it seems to me clear that is certainly not the reality of the way human beings are built. You know, you may choose whether or not you want to act on sexual desire towards somebody other than your mate. But to think that you will never be sexually attracted to anybody but your mate for your entire life, I think is unrealistic. So that was the first notion, that this is the natural order of things. The second, what I call the second myth of monogamy is, at some point in the social structure of things, the world progressed to where not too many people believed that first myth anymore. So then there was the second myth of monogamy, which was, okay, you may be attracted to other people, but it's the duty of society to make sure that nobody acts on those desires and to punish anybody who does. Which, now, this may have made sense at some point in history, for example, when there was not reliable birth control available to everybody, and if you have people acting out sexual desire to people other than their partners, you end up with babies, and who's going to take care of the babies, and all kinds of dire results. But we no longer live in that world, and so I think more and more people, I don't know what surveys have been done, but certainly most people, say in the U.S. these days, would not agree with the notion that it's society's proper function to make sure that everybody stays limited to one partner and punishes anybody who doesn't. And then the third myth of monogamy, which kind of tries to pick up the ball when the second myth falls down, is like, okay, people will act out being sexual with other people. I mean, the statistics of, you know, number of married people who have affairs, let alone non-secretive relationships with people other than their primary partners. I mean, you know, it's huge numbers of people who even admit to this, let alone all the people who don't. So the third myth was, okay, we know that lots and lots of people go outside their primary relationship or their marriage in terms of their sexual behavior, but the people who don't do that are morally superior to the people who do. So they're sort of the strong people and the weak people, or the good people and the bad people, or whatever. And we, you know, we still, we may not punish the people who stray, so to speak, but we still feel like they are inferior, you know, second rate to the people who stay true to their one partner. So so those are the three myths, and it's I think it's complicated because the whole question about monogamy keeps on getting tied into the question of honesty, which is a whole nother, and you know, in my ethical system, is a whole nother issue, right? It's one thing to say whether or not you have desire or act out being sexual with somebody other than your partner. It's another thing as to whether you are then honest with your partner about what you're doing or if you're not. And that's a very complicated question because many people will say, well, I cannot be honest with my husband or my wife about what I'm doing because they will divorce me, you know, or at least it will upset them. Why should I upset them when I can do this and just be discreet about it? And then it's kind of the best of both possible worlds. Nobody needs to feel inadequate. Nobody needs to feel rejected. And meanwhile, people get to, you know, have a wider sexual range in their lives. And you know, in the political arena, for example, you see people being criticized. Well, it's not that he had an affair; it's that he lied about it. He lied to his wife.
Yes, yes.
And I think lying in a relationship is is a real problem and real detrimental to any relationship. How intimate can you be with your partner if you always have to be running every word that comes out of your mouth through a screen to make sure you're not giving away some secret that you haven't?
Exactly. It's the opposite of emotional intimacy.
And then and that raises the whole question about whether it's possible to have sex with somebody other than your primary partner and come to an understanding with your partner where you make that okay so that you don't have to be deceitful and you can carry on from there if the two of you happen to be people who want to move in that direction. So that's kind of the basic overview.
So in my practice, I will deal with couples, and there is the affair is admitted, and sometimes that's another whole discussion, whether it should be admitted or not. But anyway, sometimes the revelation of an affair forces couples to grapple with some unsettling questions. And I think these questions should be dealt with early on in the relationship, maybe premaritally. Questions like, what does fidelity mean to us and why is it important? Is it possible to love more than one person at once? And can we learn to trust each other again? This would be after an affair. And also, how do we negotiate that elusive balance between our emotional needs and our erotic desires? These are unsettling questions and deep and penetrative questions that are really important. So I hear couples say that, and often with me sort of mediating the discussion, but in the wake of devastating betrayals, many couples will say that they're having some of the deepest and most honest conversations of their entire relationship. That is to say, their history is laid bare, unfulfilled expectations, unspoken resentments, unmet longings. You know, we know, don't we, David, that love is messy and infidelity more so.
You talk about resentments and unfulfilled expectations. I mean, this is true in the sexual arena, but it's true in the emotional arena. It's true everywhere. You know, whether you're talking about your primary partner, you're talking about your friends, you're talking about your parents, you're talking about your kids, you're talking about your brothers and sisters. You know, everybody has disappointments. Everybody gets betrayed or feels betrayed. Everybody gets abandoned or feels abandoned. And so, things happen that are painful. And these are all things that, as you say, in the course of a relationship, you either have to deal with early on along the way, or everything gets swept under the rug and starts piling up because people don't want to deal with it because it's scary or painful to try to deal with it. But so you keep on avoiding it and avoiding it until the pressure builds up to where there's an explosion, and then you're forced to deal with the accumulated, junk of however long you've been together. And I think it's really good for people to be realistic and understanding about how relationship works. I mean, sexual relationship is one piece of it, but it really is broader than sexuality. It's all the aspects of a relationship. It's not all, everything is wonderful. You always agree, or if you disagree, you're always nice and friendly about it. It's like people have severe disagreements. People have times when what they want and who they are bumps up against the other person, especially the people that you're most intimate with. You really do hurt the ones you love, because when you're intimate and open with each other, things will happen, not necessarily, maybe sometimes because somebody is vicious and uncaring, but I think much more often not because anybody is being a horrible person, but because things are complicated and difficult to address honestly. So for me, honesty is, you know, a lot comes down to levels of honesty, and I'm talking about, I don't, by honesty, I don't mean not lying.
Mm-hmm.
I think honesty goes far beyond not lying. You can not tell any lies and still be extremely dishonest with whoever you're interacting with.
Oh, but say, wait. Say a little more about that. That's a very interesting.
Well,
concept.
You know, if you can be, if I'm carrying some negative feeling about you, you know, anybody, my partner, say, and
mm-hmm.
And I don't talk about it, well, I'm not lying about anything, but I'm not being honest about how I feel. There are important parts of how I feel that I'm keeping as a secret, essentially, from my partner. Maybe it's because I don't want to hurt them. Maybe it's because I don't want to deal with their reaction if I tell them, whatever. But it is, I think every time you do that, you lower the notch of intimacy in your relationship. You know, you lower the intimacy in your relationship by one notch. And if you do that over and over again, which we all tend to do, because, I mean, otherwise you got to spend all day every day dealing with every, you know, every little thing that you might be honest about. So, but the, you know, there's some, I think there's some, so many couples that I know, they love each other, they care about each other, they have history together, they raise kids together, whatever, they go on vacations together, they have great times together. But there's a level of connection between them that's missing. And I think a lot of that comes from all these times when you do not offer your partner the full truth about who you are and how you feel. So that's what I'm talking about sort of, I don't know, radical honesty, let's say.
Yeah, I like that, radical honesty. Oscar Wilde famously said, marriage is the triumph of imagination over intelligence. And perhaps it's not the marriage per se that suggests intelligence that's been lowered. It's the nearly universal expectation, as we've been talking about, that a happy couple will forsake all others for the rest of their lives.
Right.
Without coming to despise each other in the process. I mean, some do, some don't, but...
Yeah. Well, you know, I think a lot of that is... So let's say your partner is being attracted to somebody else. Either
mm-hmm.
way, let's say you're being attracted to somebody, but just from the start, let's say your partner is being attracted to somebody else, and you're aware of that, either because they tell them or because they tell you or because they don't tell you, but you can tell. So... Then the next step is, so what? How do you interpret that? You know, what meaning do you assign to the fact that is going on? For some people, it means, oh, it means there's something wrong with me. I mean, I think that's the first thing that people tend to think, which, if you think about it, is sort of an odd reaction to that. The only reason to think that
mm-hmm.
your partner's being attracted to somebody else because there's something wrong with you is if you believe that if there wasn't something wrong with you, they would never be attracted to somebody else. But that's silly, because you walk down the street, there are attractive people. You look around your workplace, there are people who are not only, you know, attractive to the eye, but attractive, they're interesting and they're sexy in some way and they appeal to you. This doesn't mean that your partner is failing you in some way, in my opinion. And yet, if you were to go home and tell your wife, tell your husband, God, there's this person I work with, and you know, every day it's enjoyable to be around them because they have this energy, or it's confusing to be around them because I start feeling like, oh, what if I actually acted on this or whatever? If you know, and then, but you can't talk to your partner about it because the assumption is that your partner will feel negatively about the fact that you're feeling that way. So, you know, and then it's why is that? Why can't we just say that to each other and smile and say, yeah, you know, I know how you feel. I feel the same way. When I go to work, there's this guy and blah, blah, blah. And just have that be part of the ebb and flow of how we go through our lives. It seems to me that if we could do that, it would make everything so much less complicated.
But yeah, and that requires honesty and emotional intimacy. We both like Christopher Ryan, who wrote Sex at Dawn. And this is something that he wrote that really fits in with what we're talking about. So this is Christopher Ryan, Dr. Christopher Ryan. I was recently sitting in a hotel lobby when I noticed a sexy woman walking across the room. My attention then turned to a textbook miserable married couple sitting stiffly on the sofa nearby. They were unmoving, but a hurricane of resentment was raging all around them. He was bitterly pretending not to notice the sexy woman. His wife was angrily pretending not to notice that he was pretending not to notice. When they both looked at me, I pretended not to notice what they were pretending not to notice.
Yeah, right.
What a fucking mess, he writes.
Yeah, right.
Why is it still considered a taboo-busting provocation to say out loud that no matter how much we love each other, sexual passion for the familiar fades? And no matter how deep our bonds, this is still Christopher Ryan, we'll still notice and desire other people. For both men and women, erotic engagement with a novel partner, even if only a flirtation or a fantasy, can be one of the life's greatest tonics, revitalizing, enhancing, and energizing. Isn't that beautifully expressed?
Yeah, no, that's really well said. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we push it down, our attraction, some people do. So Dan Savage, and you know who he is, and let me tell listeners, he writes a column that he's in Seattle here, but his column, Savage Love, is a national column, maybe even international. But he came up with the term monogamish. And this has to do with people negotiating fidelity and infidelity and having discussions about it and being upfront. And, so you chime in on this.
I just think it's really important to do. I always feel when I get into this kind of discussion, I have to be careful because I'm aware that what makes sense to me and the way that I choose to structure, you know, my primary relationships and may not be what somebody else wants. So I don't want to end up saying, you know, anybody in their right mind, this is how you'll do it. And if you are going for monogamy, then you're just stupid. I mean, I think a lot of people would say, I don't want to deal with all the complexity and the emotional turmoil and emotional ups and downs of...
You're right, David.
Of what you're talking about, which is just I was saying how everything gets less complicated if you're honest, but it gets more complicated when you have to acknowledge, you know, the many layers of what you're feeling. And then certainly there are a lot of people who just don't have the time, don't have the space to be working on all of that. And so they are looking for a simpler solution. I can respect that, but I I have my questions about it because I think that over time, you can only bend the reality of what you're feeling so far before you start paying serious emotional and relational consequences for it. So, you know, I'm a big, when people, friends, I mean, I'm not a therapist, so I don't do this professionally, but, you know, if you write about sexuality, pretty soon every time you get together with anybody, the first thing they want to tell you about is everything that's going on with their sex lives. And
right,
I have lots of
right.
friends and acquaintances and people I barely know, you know, telling me their stories, right? In my mind, honesty is really, really, really important. Not kind of as a moral issue. It's not like, you know, you're a sinner if you lie, or you're a devious psychopath if you lie. I mean, I would be amoral enough to say I would be for lying if I thought it worked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's a functional question, you know. Yes, you can have an affair. You could probably get away with having an affair for a long time in certain circumstances without telling your partner, and then you would get to have both your partner and all that, all the happiness of your home life plus the excitement or whatever it is that the affair brings you. But I don't think there's any way that you get to not suffer the effect of carrying secrets and how it interferes with the intimacy of a relationship. And if you care about having a deeply intimate relationship, and not everybody does, and not everybody would want to have a deeply intimate relationship, even if they knew how to do it, because it's just too vulnerable and too exposing. But if you want,
that's a good point, David. Right there, yes. It takes a fairly well balanced person, or a person who's worked on themselves. Maybe they came out of a family of origin where there was something quite less than secure attachment, but they've worked on themselves. But you're right. There are many people that can't summon up that vulnerability and that trust to have a really intimate, deep relationship. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think you need to expand on that a little bit because it's a very important point.
Well, I think that's, although I would say, I mean, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that they can't. I mean, maybe they can, but maybe they just don't want to. You know, maybe they would rather write a book, you know, or paint, or climb mountains or something, you know. And their intimacy there are other forms of intimacy, right? I mean, you know, I mean, who was Picasso most intimate with? Probably with his painting, you know, and
even though he had many wives, and
so it's not, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say, oh, the people who have the deeply intimate relationship, they're the ones, you know, they're the crown of creation, and everybody else is less than that. It kind of depends what are your choices for your life, you know. What matters to you the most, and where do you want to put your energy? If you want to put your energy into making lots of money for whatever reasons, and, you know, I'm not a big fan of making lots of money, but obviously having lots of money has got all kinds of benefits, and you're willing to pay the cost for the intimacy in your relationship and your connection with your children and whatever else, because you're going to be doing, you know, whatever it takes to make that money, then go for it. And I just hope when you get to be 50, 60 years old and you've been successful and you've got your money and you've paid your cost, that you don't turn around and say, oh, I think I made a mistake. I think I should have done something else. You know, when I was young, I decided not to go that path. And now I'm 73 years old. And, I mean, I'm not destitute, but, there's all kinds of things that money could buy that I just don't have that much access to. But the things that I've gotten to do along the way, when I look back at them, I say, yep, I think I made a good choice for me, you know. So everybody's got to decide that. And in terms of intimacy of relationship, you know, it's like, how much of your life, how hard do you want to work on your relationship? You know, do you want a simple relationship, or do you want a relationship that might be deeply fulfilling in some other way, but would take a lot of work and time and energy year after year to pull that off. Do you want to invest your energy there or not? You know, and so.
So maybe we can transition to something that's related to what you're talking about. I did want to spend a little time talking about affairs, which often result because of monogamy. So there is a sociologist named Zygmunt Bauman. And Bauman speaks to, and this is the crisis of identities or lost identity that I think is involved with so many affairs. So he speaks to our nostalgia for unlived lives, unexplored identities, and roads not taken. As children, we have the opportunity to play at other roles. As adults, we often find ourselves confined by the ones we've been assigned or the ones we have chosen. When we select a partner, we commit to a story. Yet we remain forever curious. What other stories could we have been a part of? So affairs offer us a view of those other lives, a peek at the stranger within. And adultery or infidelity or however you want to describe it is the revenge of deserted possibilities. That's interesting idea, isn't it? Or many ideas in that.
I think that's really true. You know, it's you know, my personal history is that I've been in a series of long-term relationships in my life, pretty much all of which at the time I was in them were wonderful. But at some point in my life, my path moved in a different direction from my partner's path, and we would essentially look at each other and say, "Well, what do we do now?" And we would say, "Well, it's been fun, you know, but now it's time to do something else." And now there.
And
are people,
so you part
so
with
we, yeah,
in an amicable way.
Yeah, generally I'm with. At least one exception, or a couple of exceptions, I guess I'd have to say. You know, we parted well, and you know, sometimes it's more difficult, especially if one person wants to move on and the other person does not. But or some of it is how it comes up, like you say. If it comes up through an affair and it comes up with being dishonest and so on, then things are going to get messy in a hurry. But you know, so then the question is, do you want to stay in the same paradigm that you've set up for the rest of your life? Or at some point, as you were just saying, does some part of you say, God, there's a lot of worlds to explore out there. You know, maybe I want to do something else. So, and you can either end a relationship and start a new relationship, or in, you know, if you believe and can wrap your mind around polyamory and having more than one relationship, maybe you don't have to end one relationship in order to have another one. But you certainly can expand what's possible in your life. And I think if you keep on suppressing some part of you that really wants expression, but you don't know how or aren't willing to make the room for it, like you say, that part will rise up and demand to be heard, and often overthrow the apple cart in the process.
Yes, I exactly. I think that sometimes affairs are a form of self-discovery, maybe a quest for a new or lost identity. And so for these folks, infidelity is less likely to be a symptom of a problem and more likely an expansive experience that involves growth, exploration, and transformation. And some people will do that with serial monogamy. You know, they won't have affairs, but they'll stay faithful in a relationship and then move on to the next and
and
learn more. And I often ask the question in my practice, what did you learn from this past marriage? What did you learn?
Right.
And it stumps a lot of people, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question.
Yes, because
I had a therapist who said to me, he said, each new relationship that you're in is the process through which you work through the next stage of your journey, you know.
Mm.
So whatever the unfinished business is from the previous relationship, that's you will find a new relationship that puts you in the middle of what you were not paying attention to or were not working on before. So, you know, he was saying that a new relationship basically is an invitation to address and move through, just like what you were saying, Diana, like another important part of who you are as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
That part of who you are as a human being did not have room in this relationship, but will have room in that relationship. So there's a part of you that moves from here to there in order that that part of you, you know, has a home, has a place to express itself.
You know, for lots of folks, and I include myself in this, it's a journey to this kind of wisdom. You know, you and I are both in our 70s, and so we have life experience, and we have relationship experience, and we have sexual experience. And I know you're very happy with Kim. I'm extremely happy with Brian. And he's not at all jealous of my former marriages or relationships because he recognizes that it helped form who I am.
Exactly.
And I'm much more tolerant and willing to slow down and breathe and not have a lot of drama. Or we don't actually, Brian and I don't have any drama, which is remarkable in our marriage and our relationship of nearly 8 years now. But it takes time. I remember turning 40 and having some ahas. Oh, if I do this, then this happens. But it took me till I was about 40 to get that. So I would like to say to listeners out there, if you're younger, take some deep breaths, pay attention, slow down, listen to podcasts like this, or if you're listening live, a program like this, do some reading, do some therapy, and recognize that it may take some time. It may take some time to come to realizations. 'Cause I think about, I was pretty stupid in a lot of ways, in my relationship-wise, in my 20s.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
It's the
journey.
It's a path. You know, I really...
It's a path.
Joseph Campbell would talk about that, and there's a journey, and you're called out on your journey, and you know the early part of your journey when you're, like you were saying, young in your 20s is magical and special in a way that you will never be able to do when you're 70. And
that's right.
And each piece of your journey, each leg of your journey is in some sense preparation for the next leg of your journey.
Mm-hmm.
And like you know, I feel like the relationship that I have with Kim, if I had not passed through, like when I had, I guess, three or four previous long-term relationships. If I had not passed through those relationships, learned what I had to learn from them, confronted what I had to confront through them, deal with the issues that came up there, there's no way I could have the kind of relationship that I have with Kim now. I just wasn't ready for this.
Yes, you weren't ready.
Relationship. Not that it was what I was stupid. I mean, I was stupid. I mean, I'm still stupid. You know, I mean, but
less so. Though.
But not because being young means being foolish, but being young means being focused on a particular piece of the puzzle, and then being middle-aged, whatever, is a different kind of puzzle, and then being older is a different kind of piece of the puzzle. So, you know, your attention moves from here to there, but each layer, if you in fact are working on the emotional issues and the personality issues and the personal growth issues that are facing you at that point in your life, if you really work on that, then you get through that and you get to go to the next level. And I mean, to me, that's what makes life, you know, exciting. And I did a little bit of work, this is a whole off the topic, but I was in Zimbabwe, and I was working with a spiritual healer there that I had met through a friend. And in Zimbabwe, everything is run by the spirits, basically. You know, the spirits are calling you. And in Zimbabwean culture, the way to have a happy life is to listen to what your spirits are telling you and do what they're telling you to do, even if at the time it feels like, oh, my God, I don't want to do that. And this man would say, he said, you can fight your spirits, but then you'll be in turmoil, and in the end they're going to win anyway. So you might as well just give in to them, do what they're telling you to do, and get on with it. So that's kind of the way that they look at it. This kind of sense like you have a destiny. I really like the notion of destiny. Joseph Campbell, you know, the great mythologist,
sure,
and so on.
Follow your bliss.
So he tells the story of Manolete, the bullfighter. Manolete, you know, the most famous bullfighter of all time, or something like that. I don't really know that much about bullfighting. When Manolete was a child, he would dress in girls' clothes and hide behind his mother's skirts. And then the psychologist came and they said, well, Manolete became this, you know, courageous, fearless bullfighter because he was compensating for having been such a wimp when he was a kid. And Joseph Campbell said, no, they got it all wrong. If your destiny was to become Manolete, the famous fearless bullfighter, you would hide behind your mother's skirts too. That's the way he saw it. So it was the sense of what is ahead that is motivating you now, rather than the sense of what is behind, you know, determining who you are now. It sort of flips psychology on its head in a way, which, I mean, I believe in psychology and the effects of your childhood on your life and all that kind of stuff too. But I think the whole notion of this destiny, of being called in a certain direction, and then you either pay attention and respond to the call in some way, or you say, oh, I don't like that, I'm not going to do it. And in Zimbabwe, the notion is if you fight against it, you will be really miserable. It's like pushing one fist up against the other and pushing and pushing and pushing, which is a whole different thing than moving forward with the energy that your destiny is basically offering to you. So
it sounds like, David, this was a transformative experience for you to be in Zimbabwe and to do this spirit work.
Oh, it was. I mean, I was there for 3 weeks. It was
3 weeks.
You know, kind of a lark. But sure, you know, it was, I just like that whole, I just said, oh, look at that. You could look at life like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even have to look at life like that instead. You can look at life like that in addition to all the Western-oriented ways that we've been taught to look at life. So I know it's, you know, when I'm sitting around and I'm thinking, well, what about my life, and am I happy, and where do I want to go, and where do I want to go with Kim, or where do I want to go separate from Kim, and all of that, I think about all this, like, what is your true calling? What is the thing in your life that will give you the deepest pleasure and sense of meaning and purpose and just make you feel like everything is wonderful. And those are the things to pursue, but sometimes they will be scary. And, you know, so there are moments of courage where you can play it safe or you can stick your neck out there. And, you know, as what's his name? I'm forgetting his name. Stormy Daniels' lawyer said his mom gave
him. Starts with an A.
His last name is Avenatti. Like Michael, I think.
Avenatti, yeah.
Michael Avenatti posted this thing where his mother gave him a turtle, and on the bottom of when he was a kid, and on the bottom of the turtle, she had written, "The turtle only gets somewhere by putting its neck out."
yeah. That's right. And I recently, it was in a context that I won't reveal now, but I recently said to my daughter, you need to risk, because not to risk is to risk even more, you know, to have the courage to risk. And which leads me to say one last thing about kind of a positive reframe about affairs, because I often say to clients, if they could bring into their marriage one-tenth of the boldness and the playfulness that they bring to their affair, their home life would feel quite different.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, boldness and playfulness.
Yeah.
We want more bold, and we've been talking about that in one way or another through the course of this last 60 minutes.
Yes.
Boldness and playfulness and being honest and telling your truth.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which...
And you are a wonderful guest. You're so articulate. And, of course, I'll have you back. And that'll be soon, I hope. I really enjoyed talking to you, David.
That's for sure.
So, people, you said some of your people want to know how to listen live to the program. So, on my website, drdianawiley.com, on the right side, just below Love, Lust, and Laughter, the name of this program, it says click here, but you do have to click there when it's playing. So on West Coast time, it's 3 to 4. East Coast, it's 6 to 7. And then this program will be archived by tomorrow morning. For those of you listening live, you already know how to do that. You're probably listening through the PRN website. But people who know my website can listen that way, too. So I hope that didn't confuse you, David, when you were asking about how people could listen.
No, I guess that was probably it. But
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. Well, I'm surprised that the music hasn't come on yet, but maybe our producer could. There it is.
There it is. Perfect.
Thank you, David, so much.
All right, great to talk to you,
Diana. We'll do this again. I really... I appreciate your wisdom so much.
Thank you.
And who you are. Goodbye, everybody.
E se ti perderei nel labirinto di un amaro autore.